It's that time again. Hi, this is Jonathan Rose and welcome to Blind Line, Saturday the 5th of February today. Good to have you along. On the program shortly, we'll be speaking with Peter Shelley from Shrink Wrap Computers. We'll be speaking to him about how he got involved in all of this. We'll also have a discussion about the adaptive technology industry and also how he thinks his controversial views that he sometimes expresses has an impact on his business, if it does at all. Find out the answers to these and other probing questions in just a moment. After that, we'll give you the chance to have your say on any of the issues that you care to discuss. There has been a lot of discussion on the email lists around the place over the last week about the UBC documentary. You may have had some more thoughts about UBC that you want to discuss with us. We'll be happy to take your calls after the interview with Peter Shelley, as well as talking about anything that he has raised that perhaps gets your buddy phone finger punching up the numbers. So, stay tuned for the interview and then have your say. You're very, very welcome. Time now to introduce Peter Shelley. You may not know this, but he's actually Dr. Peter Shelley. He has a degree in clinical psychology, a PhD no less. And it does seem a far cry from clinical psychology to adaptive technology. So I asked Peter to explain this to us.
Well, it's sort of a long and winding story, but when I became, well, the whole time I was in school, actually beginning in high school, I was interested in computers, and as a psychologist, which I did professionally for a number of years, I found myself getting sometimes more gratification from a little bit of computer consulting and a small amount of sales than I did doing what I was doing in psychology, and that's because of a number of things that were changing at the time in the health system, how to manage healthcare in the United States. I guess I got in at the right time into adaptive technology, that is, because the business and the shrink wrap computer products just kind of grew far more than I thought it would, because I intended it to be a little cottage business just kind of on the side in addition to my other work. And as psychology began to diminish, the computer stuff began to grow. So it worked out well.
So how long ago are we talking?
Well, shrink wrap computer products was conceived in 1991. But I had been dabbling in computers in personal computers, beginning in about 1984, in the Apple days. I'd written a couple of small applications, a small banking program, and a tiny database, a filing system. But my first exposure to computers was actually in 1974.
What were you doing with computers back then?
It was in school. I was in high school. I was about 14 years old. And the school mathematics department got a computer. They invested something on the order of $20,000 and got what was then called a mini computer. It had a whopping 1.5 kilobytes of core memory and a cassette drive for storage. And I was just doing some basic programming. Of course, there was no computer screen access in those days. So it was a little tricky, but through various means, I managed to do what I needed to do.
Yeah, and those programs took forever to load off the cassette drive, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, we had a choice of cassette or paper tape. And eventually, well, I guess it wasn't really until college when I started using an opticon to access the output of the computer. The majority of the output was on paper. They didn't call it a daisy wheel printer at the time, but that's essentially what it was. So everything was produced in very clear capital letters, and it was easy to read with the opticon.
And in the 1980s, of course, as you say, the Apple were really in their heyday in the early 80s. So were you able to benefit from the use of adaptive technology as you were going through university and doing your PhD work?
When I was doing my PhD work, I was able to use a computer and actually wrote my doctoral thesis on an Apple computer using the ProWords program, and I printed it out on a daisy wheel printer, which took about a day and a half. And it was it was a made a tremendous difference, you know, between trying to write college papers in my undergraduate days and, you know, essentially using a tape recorder and an electric typewriter to going to a word processor. It was a huge difference. And I kind of decided there, even though I was training as a psychologist, I recognized that computers were pretty important to blind people.
And what was it about adaptive technology that attracted you to it, not just in the sense of providing a tool that would help you get on with your professional life, but actually instead of pursuing your career as a clinical psychologist?
Well, it wasn't as far a cry as you might think, only because, well, I recognized the value of it, but early on, even when I was a child, I always liked technology and liked pushing buttons and things that plugged in and made various noises, and I was sighted at one time, so I, at least at the time, was enjoying the full range of things. So as I lost my sight, I still wanted to maintain access to these things. But my background before getting a degree in clinical psychology, I've got a bit of a research background in information processing in the human brain, as well as neuroscience and biochemistry and that kind of thing. And there are some parallels. I mean, they're obviously very different, but there are some parallels with information processing by machines and information processing by people. So it, you know, wasn't, you know, as strange as it might have first seemed.
And you entered the industry at a good time, I would have thought, because in 1991, DOS Access was in its heyday, and a lot of people were getting into computers. It was seeming possible, and it was really before the terror of Windows, as it were, hit us, and there was a bit of an access lull for a while there. So the timing must have been about right.
The very first computers I sold didn't come with Windows at all, and then shortly thereafter, they started coming with Windows 3.0. And then, you know, Windows 3.1... sort of took off in the mainstream world, but it didn't really bother us that much because there was still lots of DOS stuff going on. But, you know, eventually I had to, you know, bite the bullet and learn Windows, and I'm glad I did. And I actually kind of like Windows these days, although I recognize its flaws, which are numerous, but I still enjoy using it.
Did you go through any kind of scientific process that determined the products that you would stock or the type of service that you would provide?
I wouldn't say a scientific process, but, you know, when I started in about 1991, I just saw a need for people to be able to advise other people on what you could do with computer equipment. And what the stuff did and what the difference was, for example, between a voice synthesizer and a screen reader. And even at the institutional level, you know, at agencies for the blind, people responsible for education of the blind or resource teachers and those sorts of people didn't really know those things either. And especially in the early 90s, in the United States, when the Americans with Disabilities Act got passed, and suddenly the government and private agencies started having to accommodate their blind employees with computers, and they needed to understand what blind people needed in the way of computers. And I've run into a large number, I wouldn't even say a few, I would say a very great many people, especially in the early 90s, who had absolutely no idea that blind people could do anything at all with a computer, and were absolutely astounded that a blind person could have any productivity with a computer. And I would, you know, people would routinely say to me, well, this employee has to be able to do word processing, and of course a blind person can't do word processing. You know, and I, you know, it was a real education process, and sometimes could be very disturbing because people were so set in their belief that blind people, you know, ought to be home and collecting disability checks. I've seen that change a lot. I mean, it's still some of it there, but it's getting better.
So there are a number of strands involved in what you're doing, I guess. You're advising
potential and current employers, and you're also advising and selling products to blind people and presumably to those prospective employers, and we've got your magazine and other things that you come to later.
Yeah, I've found myself gathering lots of information and at the same time feeling a need, I guess, to disseminate the information. So I guess that's how Bitstream was conceived. And actually, you know, Bitstream, which started on tape in 1996, existed on disc for 2 years before that, although it had very few subscribers because people weren't accustomed, again, I think, in the early 90s to receiving literature or reading material of any kind on a floppy disk and reading it. So I have a very small subscribership. When I switched over to cassette, I had much more interest. But also, Bitstream on cassette came about when Rich Ring stopped producing Computer Folks, which was a similar sort of computer magazine.
And so when you're dealing with adaptive technology products, what makes you decide, for instance, to stock Ark and Stone instead of a competitor, or promote one given screen reader ahead of another? Do you personally try all of the material that's out there and make a determination as to what's the best product in your opinion for your customers?
For the most part, I try everything. I don't sell everything, and depending on the product, there are various reasons why I might not sell something. In the case of Ark and Stone, I joined up as an Ark and Stone dealer when they were fairly young. They probably about a month before they introduced Open Book 1.0, which was in, I think, January of 92. You know, I signed on as a dealer just before that, and so I've kind of grown as a dealer as they've grown as a company. The main competitor these days, of course, is Kurzweil, and although I don't carry Kurzweil, it's mainly because of their geographical distribution of agents, of salespeople. I don't have any philosophical problem with them or their existence. There are some companies that I'd rather not name, I guess, where I have some philosophical problems with the way they do business, but for my own survival as a dealer, I may carry the product, or I may certainly voice my opinion, and anyone who knows me from any of the email lists knows that I'm not usually shy about voicing my opinion. But you know, there are times that there's, you know, demand for a product that I might not necessarily think is the best product or has the best backing, and I've likened this. Yeah, when challenged on that point, I've spoken of a friend of mine who owns a store, a grocery store, you know, and he sells cigarettes and he sells alcohol, and he uses and believes in neither of those products, but to provide the service that he's committed to provide, he has to carry them in his store, and that's kind of where I am too with some products.
Have you found yourself in a little bit of bother, a little bit of trouble, as it were, through voicing your strongly held beliefs about the practices of certain companies, yet stocking their products? Have there been situations where you've been threatened with a withdrawal of your dealership because of the comments that you've made?
Well, actually, in the case of a couple of these products, I don't have an official direct dealership. I go through third-party distributors, and as a result, you know, make a little bit less money, but I can still carry the product. And yeah, I've had both public and private confrontations with not only users who feel strongly about certain products, but also with people at the companies themselves who have voiced their annoyance with me and my opinion. And I kind of make it clear that, you know, my opinion is just that, it's my opinion, and you know, I feel free to voice it, even though I will also not argue too strongly with somebody who, you know, has good reasons for wanting a particular thing.
Are there people in the adaptive technology industry who are taking advantage of blind people, or perhaps to even put it more bluntly, ripping off blind people?
There's some of that. I think wherever you go, there are opportunists, and you know, sometimes opportunism gives rise to criminal activity, and I have, you know, certainly run into people who compete with me who do so dishonestly. I'd say that's the vast minority of people in the field, and you know, I think 99% of the people who do adaptive technology, you know, believe what they're saying and stand behind their products and deal fairly. But I've also run into some dealers who illegally copy software and sell it, which is doing a disservice both to the manufacturer and to the end user. I've run into that. I've run into people who dramatically overcharge for things. For example, and I'm by no means claiming to be a discount house, because I'm not, but for example, a sort of standard computer system these days might be a Pentium 500, and you know, the retail price for a given configuration for the computer itself might be around $1,200 or $1,300 US dollars. You know, and I've seen blindness vendors who will take the same computer where $1,300 represents more than enough profit and say, well, it's a special adaptive system and my customers are going to pay $1,900. And I think that's, you know, I really object to that sort of behavior, only because, you know, there's profit to be made, but I don't think it needs to be made by overcharging or by, you know, having people pay for more than what they're getting.
Yes, I got into an interesting discussion on a mailing list a few weeks ago where we were talking about whether the government in the US, be it state or federal, I guess, should be making more of a contribution to the costs of a blind person's costs of blindness, and in particular, in this instance, adaptive technology. And it was suggested to me that there's too much of this going on, and because of that, the price of adaptive technology is being inflated because vendors know that they are selling to government agencies, and that disadvantages the little guy who don't have access to that. Do you think that's a fair comment? A price is being inflated because government agencies can afford to pay?
Well, in my experience, the government agencies are looking for some degree of competition, and most of them will ask for bids on products, and things will still generally be a little bit inflated, but they're going to pick the least inflated of three or four people that they get pricing from. I think really the reason for the high prices in adaptive technology have to do with the limited market for it. If you take a blindness OCR product that costs $1,000, and you know, they may sell a few thousand of those per year, and you take a commercial OCR product like OmniPage or something, and they're selling several hundred thousand copies a year, you know, it's obviously easier for the commercial company to make a profit or to make a significant profit. And the, you know, the blindness product, in order to stay in business, they have to pay salaries and, you know, they have to pay their costs. And I don't think that most of the overcharging most of the high prices in the blindness market reflect anyone taking advantage of anyone else. I think it's just the reality of serving such a limited market.
Given the size of the market, and you mentioned earlier about the number of copies that are running around there that people haven't paid for, do you have some sympathy for those companies who choose to copy protect their adaptive software?
Well, yes and no. I think that it makes sense to keep track of the software through registration and through serial numbers. And here's a place where I frequently get into trouble with people, because there are certain products that are copy protected, and I feel that they can occasionally be copy protected in a punitive way. I've run into copy protection where the protection is such that it prevented the product from being used on the system, or if you go to do some modification to your system, the copy protection of this other product kicks in and, you know, severely limits or temporarily disables your use of that product. So I think in some cases copy protection is a little bit too heavy-handed. I think my favorite type of copy protection is the type of software that during the install process asks you to type in the serial number. If more of the vendors would provide their serial numbers in Braille or, and or large print, that would be a help. But I think that's a legitimate use of copy protection so that the product isn't disabled.
How do you separate the vending functions that you have from the other functions that you perform, such as the judging of the dueling scanners competition at CSUN, and also your ability to independently review products at in Bitstream? If you're selling one particular thing, how do you get past the perception, even if it's not a reality, that you've got a bias there because of what it is that you sell?
Well, I can't say that that's completely not a reality. I mean, I would be, you know, either a fool or lying if I said I wasn't influenced by, you know, what I can make a profit on. In the case of dueling scanners, the way I circumvented any problems with that is that I actually don't do the judging. I'm sort of the master of ceremonies, and I introduce people at the session and, you know, pass out the printed or brailled questions to the audience and that sort of thing, and keep things moving along. But I actually have judges at the session who are more or less impartial, or who, well, actually the vendors have in advance agreed that they accept the judges as impartial, and it's up to the judges to not only generate the questions but to generate the report at the end where they've rendered an opinion. And in this year's dueling scams, we're actually going to have the same judges that we had in 1999. We're going to have Rich Ring from the NFB and Larry Stuton from APH, and they're again going to be the judges.
And what about the Bitstream reviews? Do you get any criticism from people about, for example, when you might be comparing the latest version of Kurzweil 1000 and the latest version of OpenBook? How does that go down?
Usually I say, you know, here are the two products, or here's the new product from Kurzweil, but remember, I'm an Arkenstone dealer. And I think, I'm pretty sure people would agree that I'm pretty upfront about where my biases are. And, you know, in the introduction to Bitstream is about a 40-second introduction and closing to Bitstream that I've had produced for me by Jim Snowbarger, who's a blind producer of commercial. You probably know the term better than I would. But
he's quite brilliant, isn't he? I mean,
he does a lot of good work in commercial production, and I think he even does a lot of mainstream production. Anyhow, in these bits that he's produced for me, he even says that Shrink Wrap Computer Products is a vendor of adaptive technology for the blind and print handicapped. So right in the, if you've never listened to Bitstream before, you don't have to listen to more than about 15 seconds of it to know that I'm a vendor. And in the articles, I will say, this is a product I sell or this is a product I don't sell.
Hmm.
And I'm constantly encouraging people to submit reviews of their own for inclusion on Bitstream, and unfortunately I don't get as much of that as I would like.
And how's Bitstream going? It's you still got a pretty good subscriber base?
Yeah, it's going well. I'm just finishing up, actually, the 1999 subscription year. The subscriptions begin and end in March, just because it started in March of 96. So I'm going into my fifth year, which will be the March 2000 issue, and I'm actually very late mailing out the January 2000 issue. But there are about 300 subscribers. Most of them are in the United States, but there are several dozen in other countries, and people seem to like it. I'm always kind of surprised when I announce that it's time to resubscribe, and the phone starts ringing, and people are very quick to resubscribe. And so whatever I'm doing, it must be something, it must be right.
Have you thought of expanding your production options so that people can get Bitstream over the internet every month?
I thought about that, and prior to soliciting the 2000 subscription year, I did sort of an informal poll and I asked people to email me, and I offered the choice of of doing it on continuing on cassette, going over to audio CD, or going to real audio on the internet, and it was overwhelming that people wanted it to stay on cassette. There were a few people. There were, you know, out of 300 subscribers, maybe 10 or 20 who said, yeah, real audio would be nice, but there were probably about 150 responses from people who said, no, I want it to stay on cassette. And I guess I determined from that that maybe just, you know, I listen to an awful lot of streaming audio on the internet, but it was kind of my conclusion that maybe the bitstream audience isn't all ready for that yet, or maybe you and I and some others that we know who do a lot of work with audio on the internet, or at least listen to a lot of audio on the internet, are a minority relative to a lot of computer users. I oddly enough, have a lot of readers of Bitstream who are still using DOS, and they're using ASAP or Vocalize, and they're using DOS. And in December, I got an awful lot of phone calls from people who were worried that their computers would stop working on January 1st.
Why is that? Is that a financial thing, or is it something that runs deeper? I mean, given the access that we now have to Windows and the tremendous range of applications it opens up, why have we got so many DOS users still in the blind community?
Part of it is financial, although you can get an older or maybe a less powerful Windows system for not a whole lot of money these days. But I think there's still a lot of fear of Windows. I think, you know, Windows seems to be constantly developing, or at least, you know, Microsoft would have us believe that there's always something newer and better coming out, and it is, you know, primarily a visual operating system. And there are a lot of blind people who say to me, well, I know you can do it, but, you know, I can't learn it. There's too much. It's just too visual for me, and I don't understand how it works. You know, and you take the command line interface away from somebody, and or at least from many people, and they feel that you've taken away, you know, what they've really come to depend on or what they really like. And I think people are afraid of losing productivity by switching over to Windows because there's, you know, a potentially steep learning curve.
And you've sought to deal with that problem a little with the release of your Windows 95 tutorial. How's that gone?
That went very well, and I stopped producing that and stopped shipping that about a year ago, only because several more products came on the market as more specifically addressing later versions of Windows 95 and Windows 98. And I actually thought some of the products were better than what I had produced. I mean, I kind of liked what I had produced, and it was done in a very informal way. You know, it wasn't a straight reading of text, and it wasn't a very regimented, you know, lesson plan. It was just kind of a discussion of here's how Windows work, and a lot of people liked it, but I think just as many people didn't like it because of its lack of regimentation. And so there's so many choices on the market now, and as I said, I think the one that's on CD from APH is very good. It's Listening to Windows is the name of it. It's an interactive CD tutorial. It's a little more costly, but I really thought that was a good piece of work. And the Windows tutorials from Krista Earle, I think, are very good as well, from Crisscross Technology. So I've been kind of sending people in those directions.
Now, there are some pretty hot products out there at the moment. One of the things that I know you've been behind is the Roadrunner. Does your involvement in that run deeper than just being a vendor?
I was not at the earliest stages of the Roadrunner, but at a fairly early stage, I was contacted. The first blind person to be contacted about the Roadrunner was Larry Skudkon at the American Printing House. And in fact, it may even have been before he was at APH, when he was simply running MicroTalk. And they had Ostrich Software, that is, had conceived of the product of the Roadrunner, and they had conceived of it as a product for the sighted market. And the original design had an LCD display that gave a readout of, I think, the text, the current text, and the time, and some various other information. and that LCD display doesn't exist on the production units. Anyhow, they got in touch with Larry, and he apparently discussed with them things that could be done to it to make it more usable by blind people, and anything that is, well, not only a neat gadget, but a very useful neat gadget, you know, Larry will usually go on board with. And at some point, I think he suggested that they contact me, which they did. So I got not the earliest beta units. I got sort of the second wave of beta and was able to make a lot of suggestions about how it might be better and what they could do to improve it. And I'm still making those suggestions to this day, some of which they write down and others of which they don't write down. But when changes come along, hopefully at least some of my suggestions are incorporated into that.
Now, I can almost hear people, a few people screaming, what is this Roadrunner thing? So let's go back a step and you can tell us what it actually does.
Yeah, in fact, I know there's some confusion on the mailing list between the Roadrunner cable modem services and the Roadrunner text reader, and what I'm talking about is the Roadrunner, which is a little electronic device. It's about the size of an audio cassette. It contains a double-talk speech synthesizer along with 3 megabytes of memory, and essentially what you do is transfer text from a computer into the Roadrunner, and then with headphones you can take the Roadrunner with you and listen to, you know, many hours of text being read by the synthesizer, and it will hold between 2,000 and 3,000 pages of printed text. So on the one I keep next to my bed, I have, I think, 5 books on it right now, 3 of which I've read, and, you know, I'm still working on them. But whenever I read everything that's on it, I go back to the computer and load some more on. So it's kind of a neat device, and the biggest of, well, it's getting to be less of an objection. Some people don't really care for the double-talk synthesizer, but it's sort of an acquired taste. If you listen to a couple of books with it, you kind of get used to the way it sounds. And in fact, there's just been a price reduction on the Roadrunner, which partially reflects its popularity and partially reflects its lower production costs.
So what does it sell for now?
The list price in the U.S. is $299, and we actually sold for $279. And it, when it came on the market in November of 98, it was $349.
And it can't be, I mean, it's a nice toy, but it can't be used as a speech synthesizer for your screen reader at the moment.
No, that is by far the number one request. I'm told by the engineer who would be the one designing that it would probably almost double the cost, and it would be less expensive for someone to just buy a separate external double-talk synthesizer.
Hmm. It is a really tiny thing. Do you think people who, say, have a Braille-in speaker or a Braille-lite would also want a Roadrunner, or is this an alternative to the Braille-lite and the Braille-in speaker, say?
I run into people who are on both sides of that. Some people say, well, I don't need that. I've got a Braille-lite or a Braille-in speaker, and, you know, and that's fine because you could certainly read books with those devices. And there are other people who like the Roadrunner because of its size, because it... I mean, it really does fit into a shirt pocket easily, and you know, whenever I go anywhere, I have one with me, just because you never know when you'd have to wait for a bus or wait for something, and it's nice to have something to do.
And is there good control over speed and pitch and inflection and all those speech parameters?
Yeah, it's got the same range of voices and pitch and speed that the standard double-talk synthesizer has.
Hmm. And now, am I right in saying that you're also a vendor for the VoiceMate device?
No, I'm not. I actually just bought a VoiceMate about 3 weeks ago, and I like it a lot, but I'm not a vendor for it. I actually start at one point was vending smaller items. I was selling some of the talking caller ID boxes, the first ones that came. I can't think of the name of it now, the Voice 8000, I think it was called. anyhow, some of the early talking Polaroid D-boxes, and of course they cost a lot more then, and there was only one model, and they only did one thing, and I sold a fair number of those. I don't know if you remember the Flashback, which was one of the first really small digital voice recorders. I was selling those for a while. But as some of these things became more mainstream, they became less attractive to me as a vendor just because I couldn't match anything like the prices that Radio Shack or Circuit City or some of the big chain electronics stores would have. And I also couldn't offer the variety.
Now, without revealing your balance sheet, obviously, I'm quite interested in finding out whether this is a very profitable enterprise to be in. You know, you kind of have this image of adaptive technology vendors really struggling because of the small size of the market. Are you able to make a comfortable living from it without worrying too much about where the next penny is going to come from?
Well, fortunately, my wife works and has a fairly decent income. I would say I'm definitely not getting rich doing it, and sometimes I have to laugh. I don't know whether to cry or laugh because I'll see email messages on some of the listservs that suggest that adaptive technology dealers are really cleaning up financially, and that's definitely not the case. I would say it's an okay living. It's certainly satisfactory from the financial point of view.
There must be all sorts of disciplines involved in being a blind person running your own business, working for yourself, and rewards as well, I suppose, being your own boss, knowing that through your own efforts you either succeed or fail, and you don't get paid by the company no matter what.
Well, that's true. And you know, my income tends to be based on what's left over after a sale, which also includes other expenses. But on the other hand, I like being my own boss, and not working for somebody else is, I find very satisfying, only because whenever I have worked for somebody else, I've always felt, and maybe many, I'm sure many people feel that they could make certain decisions about certain things that are better than what has been made by a superior. And you know, when I'm in this business myself, when I'm running the business, I of course I'm able to make all the decisions, and the bad side of that is that when I make a bad decision, I immediately find out rather directly. And yeah, you know, I've made a few bad decisions, although I think most of what I've done is pretty good. In this business, you kind of live and die by the sword. You know, and it gets back to your earlier question about whether vendors are honest or dishonest, and you know what it's like to be in the adaptive technology field. Because by and large, I found that the blind community is very close-knit, or at least communicates very well. And when there's a vendor who's doing a disservice or who's not responding to what people want, you know, the word spreads very quickly. And I've seen some vendors disappear who, you know, had been very profitable, but then, you know, others came along and did either a better job or something that was perceived as a better job, and eventually these formerly profitable vendors had to close their doors.
But then, of course, you've been on the side of some pretty grueling comments on email lists, etc., from blind people, because you're fairly outspoken on those lists. Do you feel sometimes that the blind community can be a little bit hard on successful people?
I don't think hard on successful people. I think the blind community, by and large, appreciates other blind people who are successful. I've been on the side of just rubbing people the wrong way by expressing my opinion. You know, any time there's a discussion of screen readers, for example. People are rather passionate about what they use, and I'm not actually sure why that is, and I guess I tend to be as well, but you know, as a psychologist, I should probably have a better appreciation of why people feel so strongly about this, you know, not even an inanimate object, you know, it's software. And still, I express strong opinions, but, you know, I know I'm going to get strong responses to those opinions. You know, and occasionally, you know, I find it kind of amusing. I don't normally get offended by people who object to my opinions. I think that's fine. I think it's good whenever people are talking, even if the language gets a little bit strong sometimes.
Do you think that sometimes that might affect your bottom line, though? People might sort of think, well, I'm not going to go to him because he's outspoken and he ticked me off last time on a mailing list I was reading.
Oh, well, that happens, but I think it benefits me as much as it harms me. I think, you know, I find that people come to me for exactly the same reasons as they stay away from me. And, you know, I get many comments from people who call up because they're interested in a computer system, and they say, hey, I really like, you know, what you said about this subject or that subject. You know, and then I will get feedback from, you know, friends I have in the industry. You know, not everybody is a fierce competitor. I actually, and people who read me on the mailing list probably would be hard put to believe this, but I actually get along with most of the other blindness vendors. And you know, I get feedback from, say, hey, I got a sale because you know, you made this guy angry about, you know, one particular thing. To which, well, that's, you know, I'm not going to stop giving my opinion.
What are the strengths that are required in an individual to make a go of working for themselves, running their own business?
Well, fortunately, I was able to kind of ease into running my own business, and it started almost as a hobby, and so I didn't have to dive into all the aspects of it all at once, because you have, you know, I think at the first level, or when you get involved, you have to put up with things like business licenses and opening bank accounts and just determining how exactly you're going to, you know, move money around and how you're going to conduct your business and what you're going to spend money on in terms of advertising. And a lot of that is trial and error. I mean, people can advise you, and I certainly sought advice from people, you know, but when it comes down to the bottom line, you know, as a vendor, you make the decisions and you suffer the consequences. So being able to, starting it as almost a hobby, I was able to, you know, work with small enough amounts of money that mistakes didn't cost very much. And then when it started to grow, I had already kind of mapped out a path as to, you know, how I should do things and how I should conduct business. You know, and I'm still, I think, growing in terms of how I approach the business. And, you know, as people's demands change, I try to change, although, you know, I can be set in my ways, as people on who know me will tell you, but I'll try to adapt as well.
What's the future looking like for adaptive technology in your view?
I'd say the future is, in the short term, I think it's fine. I think it will continue to stay the same or maybe grow slightly. Honestly, I think that there will be, in 10 years, many fewer adaptive technology dealers, only because so much will be available in terms of off-the-shelf software, and so much will develop in terms of just being easier to use and not requiring people like me to come in there and set up a system for you. You know, one of the things I do now, in fact, the bulk of our business is not selling individual pieces of software. We do whole computer systems, and, you know, 95% of the customers are people who call up and say, you know, I don't want to deal with any of the setup stuff. I want you to bring me a computer that I can plug in and turn on. And so that's what I do. But I think in 10 years, computers will be a lot easier to plug in and turn on and not require someone like me to come in and set them up quite so much.
Do you think that there's a future for the screen reader industry, or are we going to eventually see a situation where you turn an operating system on and you add the accessibility components and you have a talking operating system?
I think there will be a talking operating system, and Windows 2000, I know, is supposed to have a capacity to do some talking. I think as long as there is not much competition in the world of operating systems, there will be a market for screen readers. And yeah, I don't think Microsoft will ever address the needs of the blind people the way that some of the big screen reader companies like Hennard Joyce or GW Micro are, you know, just in terms of screen readers. And I think that's true about OCR software as well. And I know a lot of people, you know, aren't going to want to spend the money on something like Arkenstone or Kurzweil. You know, and they're going to use an off-the-shelf system. And I think more and more people will be able to use those. But I still think there'll be a market for the blindness products, because they're always going to do things that sighted people don't need them to do. And so the mainstream products just aren't going to have the features.
Yes, it's interesting. There has been a bit of a trend towards off-the-shelf OCR products already, but it's not large at this stage, really, I wouldn't have thought.
I understand it's growing, and I understand it's growing a lot in Europe, and based partly on how much agencies are willing to pay for products. But, you know, the example I use when asked that question is, you know, producing grade 2 Braille, and you can buy either of the blind, assuming you have an embosser, you can buy either of the blindness products, and within a very short span of time, press a button and turn a printed page into a Braille page, and that's never going to happen with the off-the-shelf software.
Although perhaps there'll be some intermediary printer driver that will do all the grade 2 conversion for you in the future.
Yeah, well, that's probably so.
Mm. It's interesting to speculate, and it's been a very interesting time that we've spent. Just before we go, perhaps you could tell people how to get in touch with you if they're interested in following up any more on what we've discussed.
Sure. My 800 number, which is good in the U.S. and Canada, it's 800-377-0774, and the regular 10-digit number is 703-620-4642, and my email address is shrink, S-H-R-I-N-K, at erols.com. That's E-R-O-L-S, like in Sam. Shrink at erols.com.
And I take it that shrink wrap computers comes from the clinical psychology background, does it?
Yeah, I actually, people ask me about that all the time. And it actually, I sat down one afternoon and said, what am I going to name this company? And it didn't take me very long to come up with that. And maybe if I thought about it longer, I would have come up with something else. But yeah, shrink, you know, for the psychology end of it, and rap, which kind of has a double meaning of, you know, like talking or rapping, and also shrink wrap kind of refers to something that's sort of self-contained and wrapped and ready to go.
Yes, so, well, somebody once told me, always trust your first instincts, and I would have thought that was a very clever name.
Well, I hope so. At least it causes people to ask me, well, how'd you name it that?
it sparks
interest, if not, even if people don't think it's a very good name.
I think it's very clever. And I must say that having called you and got your automated system, it sounds just like I'm calling a Fortune 500 company. You know, you push one for this and two for that and get all the information. Very impressive.
Maybe I could interest you in some stock.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the program.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. I appreciate it.